Now we conclude our program today with another segment in our Left on the Law series. A panel of criminal and environmental lawyers from around the world has created a legal definition for ecocide on the basis of a push to criminalize mass damage and destruction of ecosystems. In this Left on the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss this campaign and the potential political use of the International Criminal Court to pursue major polluters and destroyers of the planet.
In the program of events for the 26th Conference of the Parties under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, COP26, there was a series of speakers and workshops on the Stop Ecocide campaign to criminalize actions by companies primarily that destroy the environment. Well, Mike, before we take up that campaign and the legal strategy of this Stop Ecocide work, let's start with some of the cases here in the United States that we talked about in our last Left in the Law segment. We talked about the Minnesota case and some of the civil suits brought by cities and jurisdictions around the country against oil companies. Let's start with the Minnesota case.
The Minnesota case is becoming the lead dog. It's been very competently put together by Keith Ellison, the guy who prosecuted the killers of George Floyd. It is now pending before the Eighth Circuit.
Will you say what the case is?
Well, the case is called Minnesota versus American Petroleum Institute. And for people who are really curious, there is a webpage called climatecasechart.com. all lowercase, that has a complete record of cases suing fossil fuel companies all over the world.
There are a lot of them, too.
There's lots of them, and they also feature copies of the actual briefs, the complaints made. And in the Minnesota case, there's a remarkable series of amicus briefs that have been filed that lays out really the state of the art right now about litigating against fossil fuel companies. You know, originally, the first people who sued them because they were despoiling the air and the water. But those cases generally lost because, as the lead Second Circuit case ruled against the city of New York, well, all these things are legal. The finding of gasoline, processing it, selling it, it's entirely legal. And that sort of was that until the remarkable finding of information beginning in 2015 with the Columbia School of Journalism and different investigators found that the fossil fuel companies had lied, just like the tobacco companies had lied. And they knew, in fact, decades ago that climate change was very real, that it was man-made, and their own actions were making it. They even not only knew this as reported by papers, but they made their investment choices on the inevitability of climate change. They actually allocated resources based on the anticipating seas rising and other inevitable changes that they were meanwhile saying weren't real or were all a confusing mess of uncertainty.
Now, Mike, it may seem obvious, but in a sense it's not, in that many of us are used to political players and companies lying. Advertising has a wide latitude for deception. Why is this question of deception so important in going forward with these civil suits against oil companies?
Well, it makes oil companies' behavior illegal instead of legal.
What's illegal here?
The deception. The fact you can't, it's like a business. If you promise that using this will make your teeth white, when you know that it will actually make your teeth fall out, well, that's illegal.
Even though it's widely practiced, but there's a pretty high threshold for establishing this, right? Wasn't the one issue that their own research had confirmed the very proclamations of climate activists for decades and scientists, and that they were even acting to contradict their own research findings? And so this issue of intentionality, deceive, is what's at stake here.
Yeah, intent is always a huge concept in the law. In criminal law, if you kill somebody, you can get anything from death penalty to release the next day, depending on your state of mind. You know, if it was a reasonable self-defense, you can walk. If it was unreasonable self-defense, or if you thought there was a danger around, your subjective feeling about it, all the way up to deliberate and premeditated killing, determines your penalty. And so too in the law. For example, Minnesota sued them in an effort to avoid federal court strictly on Minnesota statutes of consumer protection, saying you cannot knowingly deceive consumers. And there's three or four laws that they relied on. And they alleged as proof that the defendants had actual knowledge of the risks associated with their fossil fuel products, but didn't say anything about it.
I assume that part of the case requires you to establish the consequences of the deception. So not having your teeth white is one thing, having them fall out another, using your example. And I think that's always true in lawsuits, right? That you have to show damages of a significant nature.
Well, the damage problem is never the problem here. I mean, the damages, the evidence mounts every day, every hour, of all the damages caused by increasing atmospheric CO2 concentrations. The effects are catastrophic. The problem has been linking up behavior of fossil fuel companies to that damage. And their defense historically has been, well, maybe, these are bad things, but we're just making gas and selling it. That's a completely legitimate, entirely legal process. We're protected by 100 laws. It's something that people want us to do. We had no bad faith in any of our actions.
And they've also depended very heavily, and I think the social sciences have to some extent been complicit in this, a broad diffusion of responsibility that, well, we all share in this, we all contribute to the problem, no one actor is responsible. So these suits kind of run counter to that notion of we're all equally responsible.
Well, yeah, the defendants did develop very sophisticated public relations strategies to deny the risks of climate change, to diffuse them among all of us. And who doesn't want to be able to drive to the hospital if their loved one is sick, or go enjoy themselves in another neighborhood by driving? And also to create a doubt about the scientific consensus of global warming. Like, is it a real thing? And how does it happen if it even is a real thing? And just make everything kind of up in the air. Maybe so, maybe not. Create ambiguities, doubts, and diffuse responsibilities. It's been a conscious, deliberate, and well-funded effort done for decades.
You know, Mike, you mentioned the parallels with big tobacco, but I'd like you to comment a bit on a more recent parallel with Big Pharma, and this maybe is a segue into some of the criminal cases with Ecocide, with the Sackler family, and of course these were civil suits, but it's also been the possibilities raised around criminal suits against pharmaceutical companies with the deaths of people through prescription practices that the Sackler family knew opioids were contributing to high rates of addiction and deaths. How do you see the parallel of that with the opioid crisis and Big Pharma?
Well, there's a parallel and also a very big difference. The parallel is that human beings are completely unpredictable as individuals, but we are utterly predictable in large numbers. If we're just in that way like atoms, you know, scientists can look at a ball of radium and say with certainty that half of this will be gone in 10,000 years, but they have no idea which half will be gone. And so we don't know what any individual is going to do in his or her life, but we do know pretty exactly what will happen on a large scale. That's why insurance companies make money. They can predict, and they do predict very accurately. And the Sackler family knew very well that their products would result in large levels of addiction and death. And they proceeded anyway. Now, they defend themselves by saying this is always an individual choice. Each separate person is either weak enough or needy enough to become addicted. And it's an individual problem. It's a spiritual problem. But that is, on one level, very true. But it's also very predictable that a certain percentage of people who will become addicted to these opioids and will give up everything else in life in order to keep those opioids coming, and that they will eventually die as a result. And they proceeded with the same advertising policies with full knowledge that this would be the result on a large scale.
I think part of what's interesting about all of these campaigns against big tobacco and big oil and also big pharma is how much class politics end up kind of shaping the moral discourse around it. So tobacco moved from a signifier of women's liberation, independence, to being associated with poor people. It was very much lost status and glamour, for sure. You can't see smoking anymore in a lot of movies. You know, it's banned. And if people smoke, they need to be punished by the story. I think with oil, there may be that aspect to it in terms of who can afford an electric car. And with the opioid crisis, it was interesting how many rural white people became addicted and died from opioid overdoses, which for a long time had been framed as a problem of people who were degenerate losers, you know, lowlifers, you know, these
white trash
types of addicts. So it's kind of gained moral authority as it's moved away from oppressed people to more everyday people, although it's still, I think, more often, you know, a problem of poor and the dispossessed. But how about this, the criminal, is there anything you'd want to add to that with parallels?
Yeah, there's the ways in which fossil fuels, opioids, and big tobacco are all the same, and that they did not get called to the carpet and really closely looked at until it was shown that they were liars. Like the tobacco companies had a critical hearing before Congress where it turned out they knew for decades that smoking cigarettes would cause lung cancer, and they did nothing about it. And they tried to obscure this fact. They tried to create doubt. They tried to blame individuals. They did all the rhetorical and all the public relations things that fossil fuel companies are now doing,
which has a strong ideological grounding, especially in capitalist societies and particularly perhaps the U.S., individualizing problems.
Yeah. And then fossil fuel companies, of course, are doing the same. They're saying, trying to make it the use of oil and gas is something that's individual. So actually, they're in their sights now and are suffering and are having to increase their budgets for defending against these cases and ultimately having to pay because they were caught lying. They were caught not only lying, but spending their money in the basis of the fact that they were liars.
Let's turn to the Stop Ecocide campaign and the foundation based in Yale that brought together an international panel of environmental lawyers and activists, scientists, working to make environmental damage carried out intentionally by corporate, to some extent, governmental actors, a crime that is now, the term ecocide, which has been around for quite a while, is gathering momentum as a campaign. Can you explain the legal definition of ecocide and how that's being advanced through the international criminal courts?
Sure. You know, unlike suing and fining corporations who simply budget for this possibility, making ecocide a crime will create an arrestable offense. So there are serious movements led by one group called Stop Ecocide International, or Stop Ecocide on the Earth, that's trying to make it a crime and under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, which now lists four crimes: genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of aggression, recently added. And this, what they want to do is amend the statute to add a fifth crime of ecocide. The definition is basically a destruction of the natural world, and make that as akin to, and even a variation on, killing off people.
So what are the precedents that are used to build the case and address issues around standing and the criteria that are pretty high for using some of the statutes that were established after World War II, right, or around 1945,
yeah,
genocide. Can you list some of those criteria and how they relate to this new crime?
Well, what they want to do is first get any state which is ratified or officially agreed to the ICC can propose an amendment. There's like 123 now of these states' parties are called. And as soon as any state or a group of states submits a proposal, then people will start to see changes in the way corporations behave. Like investors, bankers, insurers, people like that will start to avoid dangerous investments because they know a law is coming within a few years, which is a valuable time period there because that would allow businesses to change their practices.
So you're speaking to partly the gap between the challenges in achieving this change in a statute, the high bar, plus how difficult it is to get convictions. There's been, a handful of them over the decades? So,
well, yeah, if they succeed, the process, the way these people are approaching it, I think is good. They're not expecting to have a statute on the books immediately, and they think that's not even necessarily what they want to do. They want to give all these corporations a chance to make significant changes. Then, after they get it proposed by one of these 123 people, you need what's called admissibility. It requires a majority of the people who have signed on to agree that the amendment can be considered.
Now, who are these signers?
123 countries, every country you've heard of, the U.S., all the European countries, most African countries, most Asian countries.
They have a designated representative or signer, signatory.
Yeah, 123 separate states have signed on and are using the International Criminal Court. So that's quite a few. And if it's finally adopted into the statute, that requires a two-thirds majority of the states. But once the law is adopted, the crime then exists, even if it's not yet enforceable. Harming nature will begin to feel the same as harming human beings is the idea. It's a crime to do that.
So there's a kind of political, rhetorical aspect of this that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in a profound way, which is really where we live. You know, it's the thing called public opinion is very nebulous, but it's enormously powerful. And finally, they would want to get ratification by the states. If the states ratify it, that is officially submit their agreement, they have to enforce the law in their own country 1 year later. And once the more countries that ratify it, then you can sue in your country for any action a big polluter does anywhere in the world. You don't need to have them offending you on your own home ground. So it becomes criminal offense in these countries under universal jurisdiction principles. Any ratifying nation can anywhere on its own soil arrest somebody who's not even from that country.
Much better than that stupid Texas abortion law.
Much, much better.
Okay, Mike, well, we'll have to follow this. It's interesting, particularly as it gets taken up around kind of the moral arguments in the climate movement and political organizing.
There are problems, too, about the International Criminal Court, but we're a long way from facing those. So
yeah.
I think this whole process of proposing it, of having it be considered as a crime, is going to start having an immediate effect all the way through to ratification. There will be significant changes made just by that process before there are any real criminal prosecutions.
Okay, so, well, this is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker today talking about lawsuits and criminal suits against oil companies suing their pants off, and now hopefully their pants are on fire as the planet itself is at risk of continuing to be on fire. So at any rate, it would be good to continue to follow this campaign to stop ecocide and also some of the civil cases here in the U.S. as well as they go forward on the legal front of the climate movement. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Jen.